In Scotland, when friends get together, they blether. When these three friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions. Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues that are live and happening in Scotland right now. We hope that you'll join us. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether.
And you could also join in our blethers on social media. You can find us as at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcasts and would love it if you could share them with your friends and leave a review on the platform of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the third series of Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston.
And as we record this, Helen, we're both sitting with all the Christmas decorations round about. Well, maybe I'm speaking out of turn.
I think you are, Liz. I'm sitting with painter's ladders and dust sheets and wet paint on doors.
But you will be ready for Christmas.
I will. I've told them the house must be operational by tomorrow evening, and then I will start putting decorations up. Not a tack will go in the wall, though, Liz. I will put nothing in the walls.
But it will smell so fresh
and clean and clean. Yes.
And you've had an enforced tidy up, so you know.
Yes. Just been up and down to the dump with things as well. So yes, it'll be great. But I made the silly decision to have the whole of the inside of the house painted in one go. So we're moving deck chairs on the Titanic from one room to the other as the painters move behind or in front of us.
But so good once it's finished.
Oh, yes.
Well, I've been doing my whirling dervish bit, getting Christmas has arrived. So a compulsory part of that is cleaning and tidying up. So I'm feeling very virtuous. I have a tidy home. And it says it all when my husband was reporting to me today that in the Times, the Scottish version of the Times newspaper, the featured walk of, I don't know if it's walk of the day or walk of the week, was the walk around Salon Hill, close to home.
Yeah, that's fantastic, because as I sit here, it's dark now, but I look up to Salon Hill. So that's really interesting.
And it was one that I hadn't actually done until lockdown. And when it was enforced exercise from home, it became a popular walk. It's quite a strenuous walk up to the top of Salon Hill, but it is indeed a beautiful walk.
Yes, you know, Liz, it's something I've never been to the top of Salon Hill. We set off one day to go up the top of Salon Hill, and it was snowing, and we ended up kind of beyond our knees in snow. So we thought, this is not right. So we went round Salon Hill instead of going up Salon Hill.
And it's quite challenging. There's a cairn at the top, and it's overshadowed by its larger neighbour, which is Knockhill. But Knockhill today is known for the racecourse, and on the top of Knockhill there's lots of communication towers. So it's not nearly as nice a walk. So if you walk up Salon Hill, your effort to get there is well rewarded with the views that you get when you're at the top. So I think even before we heard about that today, that was just topical, because we'd already decided that for this week's episode, we would talk about our favourite walks.
That's right. And you know, you're talking about Salon Hill there. And my youngest grandson went up to the top of Salon Hill when he was just months old in his big brother's backpack. Mm-hmm. Big brother's 21. So
yeah, I remember it. That was during lockdown as well, wasn't it?
That was during lockdown, yes. Ben took Finn up to the top of Salon Hill. And they went up twice because Finn, the baby, dropped his hat. And Ben didn't notice that until he got kind of about a third of the way down. So he had to go back up because he thought he could not bear the wrath of his mother if his baby brother did not have a hat on.
Well, I'm just thinking it's a good job that it was his big brother rather than his granny, because I don't think his granny would have made it up Silent Hill twice.
I don't think his granny would have done, no. So, but talking of Finn and Silent Hill, during lockdown again, once he'd managed to find his legs and was walking, still only under two, I used to walk him round the village. And one of our favourite rocks walks was to go up to the temple, what is locally known as the temple at Salon. So one of my favourite walks I'm putting down is the walk from Salon to the temple. But just across the road from my cottage, Liz, there is a little sort of way into Salon Glen, which is a beautiful little walk along the burn at Salon. And it was just opened up, Salon Glen, really, in the sort of 1979, when the owners of the Salon estate that there decided to just open up the bit on this side of the burn for people and make turn it into a community woodland. And it's absolutely beautiful. The pathway is quite reasonable. It can be very muddy at times, but it was definitely a place that we used to spend a lot of time and walk the dog along. So along the Salon Glen, sort of through these lovely, the burn, and every season is different, you know, from the bluebells in the spring to beautiful icicles. One winter, Liz, there was just beautiful icicles hanging in the glen. They were lovely. And then it can go through there right along to the next wee village, which is called Steel End. And if you come out of the glen at Steel End and just cross the road and go up the farm track, then you come to, oh, again, it's just so different all the way up. There's spring, the lambs are in the field, and in the wintertime, there's the odd pony, the sheep, and the views back over Salon Hill that we were talking about earlier. Salon Hill and up to Knock Hill are just spectacular. And just as a sort of gradual climb up the farm road, and you come to what I'm going to call a crossroads, but in actual fact, it's really across tracks. And down to one end, you can divert down to Myrie Hall. I don't know whether you've been down to Myrie Hall, Liz.
I haven't.
No. It's just a ruin. But they think it might have been an 8th or 9th century kind of monastery, you know, a Culdee monastery, because all the signs are there, which sort of it's built on a hill, and it's got a water well, just where people would, religious groups would choose to have a monastery. And then just retrace your steps and go along a little sheep track up the side of a hill above a big house called Bandrum. It's now a care home, but you come to what is known as the temple. And the temple is a stone structure, and it's round, sort of octagonal shaped. And it's of great interest because the stonemason, the architect, the builder of the temple is the same architect, builder, stonemason that built my cottage here in Salon and also a number of other houses in Salon. And so Finn and I used to do that walk quite a lot. And then just, I think, last week we did it again, Finn and I. It was a lot faster this time. He was running ahead of me. I was saying, come on, Finn, wait for Grandma. And we got up there to the temple, and the views, the last time when I was up last week, Liz, the views over the Firth of Forth, fantastic. It's called a temple, but it never was a temple. It's was built as a kind of a lookout tower, looking over the Forth, because as I say, the views across the Firth are great, spectacular. And it was an old sea captain, Archibald Hogg, who commissioned it from David, Mercer, who built it. He commissioned it, and he used to tease his wife by saying it was his little bolt hole. This was in the 1800s. This was his bolt hole, his way to escape when they had a bit of a domestic. He would just go up and sit in his temple, in his bolt hole there.
It's funny because we regularly do the walk around, you know, if we're just looking for a walk close to home. But the story I had heard was that he built it so that his wife could go up and watch for his boat sailing fourth home. So maybe that was his story and she had another.
Yes. That's right. Well, of course, it makes it a bit difficult when my wee story says he's a former sea captain. So if he was sailing home, there must have been a big domestic.
Oh, right. But it certainly is a very unusual building and it makes a lovely walk to walk around it.
And it makes a beautiful silhouette against the sunset.
It does.
With the sun setting in the west there, the silhouette there is just fantastic. And we have a friend, Liz, in the village who's a beautiful photographer, and he's done some wonderful photographs of the temple.
Uh-huh. That's Dave Hatton, regularly appears on our social media posts. Yep, shout out to him. But no, we're blessed. And you've of course, you've got the views down to the bridges. You can see down to the Forth Bridges as well.
Right over to the bridges and to Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh. Yep. It is just spectacular. And then, of course, because it's a nice walk, you can do a circular walk. You don't need to go back the way you came. You can just follow the path down through. It's like a little beech wood. It comes down at the side of the golf club.
Right, and then down the back of my house. Yep.
Back to the back of your house and down the village. So it's a nice walk, a nice circular walk, just the Salon Glen to the temple.
And both of us, Helen, both of us are keen on our walk. And so when it came to thinking about our favourite walks, you know, so many of them, but sticking with Fife because, you know, we're blessed with walks close to home, but just a little further away and you come to the coast along the side of the Firth of Forth that you're looking across when you're looking from the temple. And there you've got the Fife Coastal Walks. So when I come to thinking about my favourite walks, at least one of them has to be part of the Fife Coastal Path because it's just fantastic opportunities the whole way. You talked about the glen in springtime, the wildflowers in the glen. We've done lots on that previously on some of the wildflowers there, but across the whole of Fife, particularly where you get to the coast, fantastic wildflowers. I love walking along the Fife Coastal Path and thinking about, you know, what part of it is my favourite. Difficult to decide, but I love the little stretch that goes from Ely to St Monans. Beautiful, beautiful for the wildflowers. You start off in Ely, I mean, that in itself, you could cover an episode of that. But as you walk along the path, there's so many fantastic sites, you know, ruins that you see. One of them, Newark Castle, sticks out on a promontory. It was once the home of Alexander III of Scotland, the one that fell over the cliff on his horse.
Yes.
That's famous in Scottish history, but he was brought up there as a guardian of Alexander. He was the guardian of Alexander II. So it was at one time this magnificent castle. But of course, with it being built on the cliff top, erosion has meant that bit by bit, it's just crumbled and fallen into the sea. So it stands there as this beautiful ruin on the promontory at the start of the walk. And then walking a little bit further along, you come to another fantastic site, which is right on the coast, and it's St Monans Church. And this is often said to be the church in Scotland that is closest to the sea. It's only about 2 metres from the sea in certain places. It's actually perched right on a low rock, really, really close to the sea. The waves lapping at the seawall, and then slightly back from the seawall, you've got the church itself. Now, why there's a church here? There's various reasons given. They say that it was maybe an Irish missionary who came to this part of a Fife in the 9th century and then was killed by the Danes, or others claim that it was a saint called St Aidan who was killed on the Isle of May, in which some 6,000 Christians from Fife were said. Whatever the reason, probably the most important reason given for a church here is that it contained the relics of St Monan. And very quickly, these relics became associated with miracles. And wherever you got miracles, we've talked before about pilgrims coming. And so this little church here became the site of pilgrimage. And because there was these miracles, it attracted lots and lots of pilgrims, including David II of Scotland. This is back to the 14th century. And David II of Scotland was the son of King Robert the Bruce. And when he suffered terrible injuries at the Battle of Neville's Cross, he came here to the church to be healed. And when he recovered from his injuries, he built the church. The story goes, he built the church in gratitude at the site of these relics of St Monan. And it became very important. But during the Reformation, the church was destroyed and was rebuilt to what you see today. And it is a beautiful church. And if you're lucky enough to get inside it, you're able to see that suspended from the ceiling, it's got a sailing ship. Have you ever been inside it?
Yeah, I was just thinking that, Liz, when you were talking. I don't think I have been inside St Modans, but I'm looking at the architect was William Byrne. Now, isn't he associated with St Giles in Edinburgh?
Yes, very much so. They say that he was a Victorian vandal, that he, it was the Victorians loved to put things in their style. Yes. But in this case, I've not actually been inside it either. I'd really like to get in and see this sailing ship because as you walk along the coast from the church, you come to the little village of St Monans itself. And before it became associated with the saint, it was originally called Inverie because it's situated at the mouth of the Inverie Burn. And so it was said that this burn, the spring that came out of the ground here, had holy powers. This was the story of the miracles. And so fishermen from the area would dip their nets into the water to secure a good catch. But also it was here that the pilgrims came to take the water to recover. So St Monans, the motto of the town is Mare Vivimus, we live by the sea. And this really tells the story of this little village because it was a very important port. But originally there were two communities because you had the fishing port down on the water, but the whole of this area of Fife is famous for its raised beaches, where after the glaciers began to melt, the ground, the land bounced back as the pressure of the glaciers was released. And so you got these raised beaches, which were very fertile. So higher up, you had the farming community, where they would use the seaweed to fertilise their crops, so very good fertile land. And then you had the fishing community. By the 18th century, haddock was the main crop, and it was sold in Edinburgh. They took it from here to Edinburgh. And also herring, which was the silver darlings were the main produce of all the way along the coast here. You've got the smokehouses at Pittenweem and Anstruther. So very famous for fishing. And with the fishing, boat building. And so you've still got the remains of what was a really important shipbuilding centre, boat building. We Fifers, little fishing boats that they produced here. But also, we're very famous with the Calmac ferries. We're very familiar with the Calmac ferries, the MV Loch Tarbert and Loch Buoy. They were both built here at St Monans, so very famous in its time. It's a lovely village, lots of Scottish vernacular buildings. You've got the red pan tiles, you've got the crow-stepped gables, the four stairs, and possibly when people think about St Monans, the Welly Boot Garden. Have you seen that?
No, but we've got Welly Boots hanging up there. Up at the top of Salon as well, on the walk that I was talking about. But that, they'll tell me about the Welly Boot Garden, Liz.
It's just someone that has painted the Welly Boots, and every spring they put plants and bulbs into them. And there's over 200 old Wellies now. So it's quite good for photographs.
Salon's got a long way to go. They've probably about 12 or 20 Welly Boots in the garden up the road.
Yeah, well, just one of the lots of the little villages that you get along the coastal path. Well, well worth a visit. And of course, another famous structure, the St Monans Windmill, which is the remains of the salt panning days. You know, Cooris, famous for its salt. All the way along the coast again, they would use the coal, which was abundant, and they would bring in the salt water. And this was the role of the windmill to bring the salt water up into these pans where they'd use the coal to evaporate and collect salt for export. So really interesting walks along this Fife coastal path.
And I think with the salt industry, Liz, I think there's an entrepreneur has started it up again in St Monans,
right,
doing similar, the old methods, but not quite so crudely as they were the old salt pans. But apparently the salt is quite special and chefs now are asking for St Monans salt again, as they are with other types of salts that are being produced, much better than what you buy in the supermarket, apparently, for cooking. Has a definite taste.
Foodies will be after it, yes.
Foodies will be after it, yes.
So where's your second walk, Helen?
Well, I'm going back to my roots, Liz. I thought
going
you'd laugh
back
at that.
To my roots.
Yes, going back to my roots. The back walk in Stirling. You all know that I come from Stirling. I'm a daughter of the rock. And this is a walk up the rock, the back walk. And it's got fantastic views over the Campsie Fells and Ben Lomond and Ben Leddy, provided the weather's good, of course. But it also it's on proper surfaced paths. It's one of the oldest urban walkways in Scotland. And it starts, the walk starts very close to where I grew up in Stirling. And you just follow the town wall, the old town wall of Stirling, which was built, the town wall was built in the 16th century. The 16th century is when Mary, Queen of Scots, was born and when Henry VIII of England was deciding that he thought it would be a good idea if this young Queen of Scotland could be betrothed to his son and that would bring the two countries together. But the people of Scotland had a different idea, Liz, and we decided no. But Henry VIII said, what I can't have by treaty, I'll take by force. And he came rampaging up into Scotland, carrying out what became known as the rough wooing of this young queen, this baby, literally a baby. And so the royal palace at Stirling became very much of a target for Henry VIII and his men. So it had to be protected. So the town wall was built 5 foot thick in places and over 20 foot high. And it was built on top of the volcanic rock that creates the geological structure of the Crag and Tail, upon which the castle is on the very top of it. But the only part of it that was, you know, not defended, the wall was round and they had gates on it. The Barras Yett was the one, the main one for people coming and going. And they had little fortifications, little towers, gun towers along the wall. But they also, the people on the north side of the castle were told to keep their garden walls at a particular height and to maintain them. That was the defence of Stirling. But so we're going along this walk, which is at the along the site of the walls, following the walls. But the kind of the person who's standing at the entrance to the walk, there's two things standing at the entrance. One is Campbell Bannerman, who was the Prime Minister, also MP for Stirling. And he was at us in the sort of the early, very early 1900s. But, you know, Liz, Campbell Bannerman is the only Prime Minister to die in number 10 Downing Street. He resigned because for ill health 19 days before he died. And I think the people felt, well, he was so ill at that time, it would be a shame to move him. So he's the only man who actually died in number 10.
And wasn't he responsible for bringing in old age pensions?
Yes, he did. He was a liberal man, and he really brought in a lot of really good things. I think his short reign as Prime Minister brought in a lot of good things, including that, yes. But the other thing guarding the entrance to this walkway is the Stirling Wolf. There's a lot of wonderful wood carvings along the walk, and the one is the Stirling Wolf. Now, the Stirling Wolf is very important to Stirling. Some people think of wolves as being dangerous, but Stirling, we are very soft and very fond of the wolf, because back in the day when the Vikings, the Danes, were trying to attack Stirling, the sentries had fallen asleep, but it was the howling of the wolf that awakened them to alert them that the Danes were attacking the town. So they wakened up and got sorted out and drove off the Danes. So Stirling survives from that. But as you go up the back walk, it was created between 1724 and 1791. And one of, as I say, one of not just Scotland, but one of Europe's finest urban walkways. And it draws many tourists to it as well as locals. When Stirling Castle was used as a barracks, which was right through from when James VI went down to England in 1603 to when the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders marched out in 1964, the trees along the back walk and were kept quite short for security reasons. But after the soldiers marched out, they were allowed to grow until the council decided we really have to do something with this and kind of do some husbandry around the trees. So they sort of started that up, and some trees had fallen down. So they started doing these wonderful wood carvings. The first one was done in 2009 by a woodcarver, created the first piece of art from a felled tree. And then more carvings were added in 2015. And it's now a wonderful walkway through all these carvings. And you've got things like the Stirling Jug. Now, from 1458 until the Union of the Crowns, or the Union of Parliaments in 1707, the official measurement in Scotland's large pint, for Scotland's large pint, was the sterling jug. And copies of this jug, and it was a large pint. It was equivalent to something like 1.8 litres, three and a quarter imperial pints. So this sterling jug, copies of it were made, and throughout the whole of Scotland, their pints would be measured by the sterling jug. So when you ordered a pint in Scotland, you were actually getting 3 pints in one.
Well, that explains a lot, Helen, as I'm listening to this. Daughter of the Rock. Does the same thing apply to measures of wine? Does it one wine glass equals three? Yeah, that I could believe, yeah.
Actually, Liz, that makes so much sense. That means you'll understand why. I mean, Prosecco just goes down like water.
True, Daughter of the Rock.
Yes.
Well,
anyway, one of the other things along there, Liz, is the post box. Now, you think, why is there a post box? And they thought, oh, it's gone up because Andy Murray, who comes from Stirling area, the tennis player, got a gold at the Olympics. No, nothing to do with Andy Murray. It's because Stirling, there was I don't know what you'd call him. He was a businessman, but he started printing leaflets of a religious nature in about 1848 and sending those out, these tracts, religious tracts, out all around the world. So much so that, if you like, that was the first mail order, because they had to build a bigger post office and sorting office in Stirling, you know, compared to the head of population than anywhere else in the UK. And the post box kind of is the little nod to that. So but the walkway along the back walk has just got really, really so many things of interest, Liz. And you're passing historic buildings like Cowan's Hospital from the 17th century. And eventually you can wander through the old kirkyard of the Church of the Holy Rood, the second oldest building in Stirling after the castle. You can wander through that, take the educational walk through the hygienic cemetery, and then make your... Yeah, I know.
Helen, you get you onto the topic of Stirling and you could go on all day.
Could go on all day, Liz.
Visit Scotland contacted you as ambassador for Stirling.
Yes, well, I think so. I think that could be it. But anyway, we would end up at the castle, and you'll just through these cemeteries full of interest, Liz. And I just urge anybody coming to Stirling, don't just park at the Esplanade and do the castle and drive away again. Take a walk and find out so much more about the town, and just so many interesting things and people have happened, including the world's oldest football, which goes back to Mary Queen of Scots.
And if you're looking for a guide, I just happen to know this guide would make an excellent tour of Stirling. I think she's done her own publicity here. By contrast, when I'm looking at my favourite walks, there has to be something that's on the islands, because you know how much I love the islands. So it was either the Tombola, which is a strip of land up in Shetland, St Ninian's up there. But no, I decided to go west to the Western Isles. And one of my favourite walks, it's not that long, you can do it quickly, it only takes about 30 minutes, but it's at Northden, which is on the Isle of Harris on the Western Isles. And of course, the Western Isles famous for their beaches. Beautiful, beautiful scenery there, and Harris in particular. And this time it's Northern Beach, which is not one of the more famous ones, but the views are absolutely stunning. And you start off in the little Crofting Township. Crofts up here cover the whole of the Western Isles. And if you're on the coast all the way around, you have this border, which is known as the Macher, which is this strip of land between the land and the sea where nothing very much grows, and it's just sand dunes and particularly the wild flowers of the Macher of the Western Isles. So if you do this in springtime, my goodness, the wildflowers here are just phenomenal. So there's a little cafe, Northden Cafe, where it has a car park, and you can park your car here, walk down towards the coast, go through a gate, And then you're on to this well-trodden path that leads out along the side of the coast. And you're sharing it with Highland cattle and Hebridean sheep that are grazing along the land here. And you just keep on heading out along the track. It's easy going across the Macher. It's very well drained, so it's not usually muddy or dirty. And you can watch the wildlife, the bird life as you're walking along. You go through a second gate and then it begins to climb quite steeply. But once you keep on going, eventually you'll come to a headland and on it sits a temple. So today is very much a story of temples.
Temples but this, and churches.
Yeah, absolutely, Christmas time. But this is a medieval chapel that was once the parish church. It was built around about the 16th century. If anybody's ever been to Harris, they've maybe visited St Clement's Church at Rodel, which is more famous as it, but similar sort of era, the 16th century. And it was built there as a place of worship on this headland. But as you explore it, you see that this was not the first religious building to be here. They know that there was a chapel built by the Vikings, but even before that, there was an Iron Age broch, so going right back to the Iron Age, a defensive tower, but also a religious tower. So this beautiful spot, this headland overlooking the sea, has had this strong religious appeal going right back in time. And as you stand there today, fantastic photos. You can take them through the windows of this chapel. You can look at the cup marks going back to prehistoric cup marks there. We don't know the story that they were telling, but you can go look across through the windows down to Scarista Beach, one of the most beautiful beaches, and just an amazing walk. If anybody's a fan of Hammond Innes, the author, his 1962 novel Atlantic Fury, he based some of the action here at Northden and out at the chapel here. So a beautiful little walk, just 30 minutes, bit of a hike at the end when you're climbing up towards the end. But other than that, very straightforward. And if you do it in early springtime, you've got all this beautiful wildflowers of the Macher as well.
Oh, Liz, that sounds a lovely walk. I like the idea of 30 minutes. That sounds great. And I think you mentioned a coffee shop as well at one point.
Yes. So. And it is a really special, the Temple Cafe it's called now at Northden. So really recommend the Western Isles and a lovely walk.
Yes, and of course, when you're walking in the Western Isles, you get that wonderful air, that fresh sea air. And of course, you get the Western Isles hair as well when you're walking.
You look a bit like a Hebridean sheep.
That's right, yes.
Or a hairy coo, depending on the colour and length of your hair.
So,
where are you taking us?
I'm going to take you somewhere a little more inland. It's up to Dunkeld, to a place familiar to both of us, Liz, the Hermitage. And I think some of our Rick Steves people that have been on tour with us will know the Hermitage as well. It's officially known as the Hermitage Pleasure Ground, and it belongs now to the National Trust for Scotland. And it's was originally sort of created by John Murray, the third Duke of Atholl, who lived in Dunkeld House. At that time, Dunkeld House was actually in Dunkeld. We stay with its in its reincarnation of Dunkeld House Hotel, don't we? Mm-hmm. He built this pleasure garden, this hermitage, in honour of the blind bard of Ossian, the blind bard Ossian. And, you know, we'll come back to who Ossian was. But anyway, you park up in a car park and then you walk along this sort of walk by the River Bran, B-R-A-A-N. And the River Bran can be either just a gentle babbling brook or a raging torrent. I've seen it in both guises, and it is beautiful just coming over all these stones. It's all sort of created by the ice age and volcanic activity. It's just beautiful coming down there. But the first side, as I say, is along by the river, and to get to it you go under a kind of a railway, but it's through a quite a narrow tunnel. So you leave a car park, which is kind of, you know, busy, out in through this tunnel to this sort of nice open woodland. It's beautiful. And just you walk along, you come out to really a stretch of Douglas fir trees, big, tall trees, sort of the highest trees, tallest trees in the UK, these Douglas firs. And along there, just as you walk through, there's a couple of wood carvings as well there. Liz, I think, are they supposed to be pine cones or something, these wood carvings?
Yeah, it goes back to, there was a link with the Squamish, the Native Americans, yes. And yes. It was a carver from them that did it. I've never found out the story behind it, but that's the link.
Yes, we'll come on to the Squamish in a minute because they also did the totem pole.
Yeah.
But when you walk into this, you come into kind of almost like a clearing, and then you're at a lovely black pool where, if you're lucky, you'll see the salmon just gathering and resting before they do the next bit, going up the Black Lynn Falls. But the Douglas Fir on the other side of the water there was actually the highest, one of the tallest trees in the UK. But sadly, in a storm in January 2017, it came down, and it was actually at a height of over 200 feet at that time when it came down. But they reckon it was probably planted in 1750s and was around 267 years old when it was came down in the storm. So you can kind of understand it was getting weak, Liz.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost no earth for a tree to grow in there. It's right down by the river, and you have very little for its roots. But we still have very, very, very tall Douglas fir trees there. And you know, the path at one time kind of deviates a little from the river, and then you come back to the river just so that you can just be aware of the dramatic effect of the water and the waterfall, because you come up to an old bridge, and on that old bridge you've got a cedar of Lebanon tree, which is believed to be the oldest tree in the Hermitage now, probably planted about early 1700s. And the bridge, of course, is 1770, and it looks as if it's actually growing on the bridge at that point. And then, as I say, the Black Lynn Falls that you've got. From the bridge, you can see them, and they look very dramatic. And I've stood on the bridge and watched salmon leaping up the falls. And you think, how do they do that? There must be an easier way of going to a spawning ground. But they leap up, and we don't leap up the falls. We go up and clamber up a little bit of a rocky staircase, and we come to what is known as Ossian's Hall. And this is like a folly. It was built in 1757, part of this, the Duke of Athol's pleasure garden here, is a focal point of the designed forest. And it's supposed to give dramatic effect. You go in, and as I tell the people that I take in, this is where the butler would be offering you your canopies, etc. And then you open the inner door to reveal the great reveal of these falls. And you can go out through the Hall of Mirrors to the balcony overlooking the falls. But the Hall of Mirrors is a funny one, Liz. It's called Ossian's Hall, but who was Ossian? And it's been described as the greatest ever literary hoax, because in the 1760s, a poet called James Macpherson sort of said he'd come across these writings of Ossian, a blind third century Gaelic warrior. And James Macpherson had translated them out of the Gaelic into English. And everybody thought, oh, they're wonderful. These are fantastic. They are great. And they kind of, transformed the view of poetry into this romantic movement that was coming in. But then it was discovered that Macpherson's translations, in inverted commas, of Highland epics were largely poems that he had written himself, based loosely on songs and tales that he'd gathered over the previous sort of year, 1760, 1761. And people said, ah. Now, it always strikes me, Liz, because they were not written in the third century by a blind poet, but were written in the 18th century by James Macpherson, does that make them any less good as poetry?
Well, I think it was all about this romantic era. I mean, the Earl of Athol, the third Earl, John Murray, was on a mission. I mean, you've got to think about the date. The date is the end of the 1700s. We've had the events of Culloden, And as far as people in the south are concerned, the Highlands are barbaric. You know, it's just savages living up here. And you had to write your last will and testament before you came north. And so John Murray was a bit peeved by this. And so he set out to try and impress his guests that were coming up to visit and show them we weren't all Highland savages and heathens, and we were very civilized. And you mentioned that this was the beginning of the Romantic era, where people were beginning to look with awe and wonder at nature and all its beauty and you know, the impact of it, the scenery, the water, the wild nature of the place. And so he was a man who just didn't know when to give up. He started off with a walk along the River Bran. Oh, this was beautiful. Well, let's improve it a wee bit. How can we improve it? Send out plant hunters, bring people like David Douglas in with all their fancy trees, make a cathedral of trees, but they take a long time to grow. So what will we do? Oh, let's put in a sensory garden. We'll have honeysuckle, we'll have rose, we'll have lavender. We'll impress the visitors with the scent of all of this. How can we improve it a little bit more? Oh, well, there's a cave here.
Oh,
you can put little shiny pebbles inside the cave and make it look, let's improve it even further. Let's build a summer house and then let's make it into Austrian soil. So it was a man that kept on improving and improving and trying to impress his visitors more and more. And today it's a wonderful walk along the side of the River Bran.
Oh, it is. And of course, with the poems of Ossian have been sort of revealed as being little bits of sort of a hoax, but he didn't stop with just building Ossian's Hall, the Earl of Atholl. He actually then decided, this road needs a hermit, and so he found a kind of a gathering of boulders, which he then enhanced a little bit to make it look like a cave further up. And then he tried to get somebody to be a hermit. And eventually, it wasn't until the 1800s that Donald Anderson, who was a local man who acted as a guide, dressed up as a hermit with a long beard of lichen and clothes of animal skins, and used to just appear in the forest through the woods for the enjoyment of the guests who were wandering along. But some kids nowadays, it's kind of come 21st century. The cave is sometimes known as the Gruffalo cage, cave. And the children love exploring it because you can go in and come out, go in one end and come out the other end. But then you can follow the track down, make it a circuit, and you come down again through the beautiful woodland. And then you suddenly come across a totem pole. And you mentioned the Squamish Native Americans, the First Nations group from Canada. They came over in 2001, and the National Trust for Scotland had donated a Douglas fir tree to be carved into a totem pole for the local primary school, for the local school in Dunkeld. And the Squamish people were helping to do that. And then just as a surprise gift, a sister totem pole was made for the Hermitage. So that's why there's one in the Hermitage as well. So, and then the walk just takes us back down to the car park. But all the people I've had there, Liz, they just think it's a very relaxing and a beautiful walk, because again, like everything else, it's different every day.
Yeah, well, the people who've been with me, if there's anybody listening who's been on my tour, know that it's my diva moment, because I love to set it all up. They travel as if they are guests. I can't help thinking that an invitation to come and stay at Dunkeld House must have been one of the most sought after tickets of the 18th century, the end of the 18th century, 19th century. And so I get them as my visitors coming with me, and we're walking along, we're smelling the scented garden, and then we come across this. What is it? It's got a door. Will we go in? Yes. And it's a bit like bringing them into the Hollywood Tower of Terror. They're waiting for the floor to collapse. And then at a signal from the Duke, the trusted servant slid back the door. Oh my goodness, where it was all the mirrored hall, and the waterfall was flowing all around you. So it's my diva moment. I love a walk up to the to Dunkeld. But we're spending so much time, Helen. I want to finish off my last one.
Yes,
because my last one is so close to my home up in the Highlands, the Cairngorm National Park. And if anybody goes up there, then most people who've ever visited Aviemore are well familiar with a walk, which is a walk around Loch an Eilean, Loch of the Island.
Yes.
It's very, very popular. Bird watchers do it, walkers, mountain bikers. It's just 3 miles outside Aviemore, and it's very easy. It's very flat. It's very accessible. So it's very, very popular. My husband creates nowadays, because it's so popular, that the grants of Rothy Merkis that own the estate have made people pay for the car park, and he takes very hard done by. He's got to pay for this, to the extent that he'll drop us off and go and park the car somewhere else to stop paying for it. He thinks that locals should get it for free. Anyway, once you've parked and you've got this, you've then got this beautiful walk around this loch. Very easy to walk around, just about 3 miles. It takes, it doesn't take long to go around it. And it's beautiful no matter what the season. Got lots of birds. The Cairngorm National Park, known for the variety of birds that you found up there. But it's just so stunningly beautiful. It's got fir tree and pine trees by the side of the loch. And indeed, it was voted at one time the UK's favourite picnic spot, because it's just this park where, just beside the car park, a lovely area to have it. But so much history as you walk around. One of the first things that you see just at the car park is a limestone kiln. And that's because they used to collect the limestone from the rock face just beside the loch, and they used to get the potash from it, which they would use to fertilise the fields. So the limestone kiln is just there. Also, the other big industry of the area was logging. The Scots pine forests were cut down and the logs were floated down the loch. And along the side of the loch, it was also famous for cattle reavers. Some people might have heard of Rob Roy, which is perhaps, he was the sort of Scottish Robin Hood, but he was famous for cattle reaving, stealing cattle. And one of the routes along the side of the loch was actually known as Robber's Way, because this was the way that they drove the cattle down from the Highlands down to the Lowlands. So a very famous area, but perhaps most famous for the island in the middle of the loch. Now, at this time of year, the loch does freeze. If it gets consecutive days of low temperatures, then the loch will freeze. But you see people walking out to the island. Ooh. Very dangerous, because there are channels in the loch. And so although it looks as if it's got a good depth of ice on it, very dangerous, because there are areas where the ice is thin and it's very, very treacherous to walk out to it. But this island in the centre of the loch has a little ruin of a castle, a 14th century castle, and it was said that it was originally constructed for these thieves and robbers as a place of refuge. It was said that there was a causeway which led out to the castle, that they knew the causeway. Nowadays it's been drowned when the water level of the loch rose, when they put a dam onto the loch. In its time, it was used by Jacobites after the Battle of Cromdale in 1690. They retreated and tried to take the castle by force, but Dame Grizel Moore Grant, one of the Grants, the fifth Laird, is still Grants today that own Rothy Merkis, but back to the time of the fifth Grant, his widow, Grizel Moore, big Grizel, she held it off from the Jacobites, and they ran off and they didn't get their hands on it. But perhaps the most famous resident was one that, again, coming back to Dunkeld. If anybody's been into the cathedral at Dunkeld, you have the tomb, the effigy of the Wolf of Badenoch, a Badgen, a second son, who was not a nice man to know. And in his time, he took the castle by force and held it as a refuge when he was being chased. So it's had its history, but today, very atmospheric. And as I say, no matter what time of year, you've got the ice, the loch freezing in the winter, you've got the spring, you've got the summer when all the birds are singing. A lovely walk. And if anybody, just to finish off, if anybody has ever seen the BBC television's Monarch of the Glen, I know that many of our listeners watch BBC television Monarch of the Glen, it was the site of the island graveyard. If you've ever seen that as part of the story in Monarch of the Glen, that's, you've seen Loch an Eilean.
Oh, that's lovely. And I love that loch, Liz. It's just beautiful. And of course, the Wolf of Badenoch, he seemed to have a few wee islands because he'd Lochendorb up, and the Dava Moor was his as well, wasn't it? He was a real wolf. He just liked his lair.
Yeah. But that's part of the... When you go on a walk in Scotland, so much history, so much to see, so much of interest. You know, it's, we both love our walks. And that brings us to our word of the week. And
oh, my goodness.
I haven't thought of one, so I'll go first while you think. Right? Because part of what I love to do is just to go and wander aimlessly, without purpose, you know, just to wander. And in Scotland, we have a word for that, which is stravaging. I love a good stravag, a good wander, just to see what I can find.
Yeah, well, that's a very good word, Liz. And while you were saying that, and you were saying going for a walk, I think nowadays I just go for a wee donner. A wee donder, wee donner, D-A-U-N-D-E-R, a donner. And because I'm affy wabbit at the end of it.
Well, I think people are going to be affy wabbit having listened to this episode. Yeah, you get us together. You get a good blether. You've had your money's worth on this episode. Right. Hopefully people have learned a little bit about some of the walks. But more than that, just about how no matter where you go walking in Scotland, there's always something of interest.
Yes. And also, Liz, I think what we've done is we've highlighted some fantastic areas that are off the beaten track,
yes,
that are not on the tourist routes, really.
Yes, so I think the title of this is The Road Less Travelled. Maybe not when it comes to Lough Inniu, which tends to be rather busy.
Or I suppose the Hermitage.
Yes, this is true. So maybe it's not The Road Less Travelled, but certainly well worth coming and taking a walk along.
Yeah. Okay, Liz, well, thank you very much. That was great. I enjoyed blethering with you.
Thank you. And we've got Christmas to come, but by the time people hear this, I hope you've had a wonderful festive season.
Yes. Happy Christmas to everybody and your festive season and a good new year.
And we'll no doubt start the new year with what's topical in Scotland in our next episode. So bye for now.
Bye for now.
And there we have it, the end of another episode of Scottish Blethers. If you'd like to join us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as @ScottishBlethers. And if you'd like to leave a review, please do so on your podcast platform of choice. It's cheery bye from me.
Ta-ta the moo from me.
And if I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the windy from me.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.